I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. On June 25th, 1876, Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer and 220 men rode into battle against the Sioux and Cheyenne beside Little Bighorn River in Montana and were never seen alive again. But what if there had been a survivor? John Huff Jr.'s latest novel, Little Bighorn, explores that what if and brings to life the soldiers and civilians on their infamous quest to conquer Sitting Bull. And he joins us in studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So before we get to the novel, put the Battle of Little Bighorn into historical perspective for us. It was the 1870s. The U.S. was trying to expand westward, and there were issues of territorial rights with Native Americans.
The government had ceded an area called the Black Hills in South Dakota to the Sioux and Cheyenne forever. It was sacred ground to them, and we had decided to let them have it and let them roam free in and around the Black Hills. Someone found gold there. And in fact, it was George Custer and his 7th Cavalry who led the expedition into the Black Hills with supposedly a scientific expedition. They had geologists along, and they found gold. And from then on, what happened was inevitable. People came swarming in. The Indians went after them. There was killing. And the government in Washington decided it was time to put an end to the wild Sioux and Cheyenne in Dakota, Montana. They moved around. They didn't stay in one place. We decided that enough was enough, and this was going to be one climactic campaign. Three armies converging, bring the Indians to battle, force them back to the reservations, and enforce a peace. They had sent out an ultimatum in that winter, announcing that all Indians must return to their reservations by the spring, or they could consider themselves at war.
Mm-hmm. And you can see from the Indians' perspective, hey, you, this is the land we agreed that we would have.
It was an outrageous violation of a treaty. We gave them the Black Hills. The army made a half-hearted attempt to keep people out. They would intercept prospectors going in there and turn them away, but they couldn't stop all of them. And it was half-hearted. Half-hearted anyway. So this is the context. Custer's 7th Cavalry was one of three columns, large columns that were to converge on the Indians and bring them to battle. As I said, Custer got there first, as we all know.
Mm-hmm. So you've had this fascination with the Battle of Little Bighorn since you were a kid. Why?
This is a question I'm going to be struggling to answer. Why? What is it about this battle? There is a fascination there, Mindy. There have been, and this is incredible, but this is a fact, over 100 novels written about the Little Bighorn. There are more histories of this battle than there are of the Battle of Gettysburg, Waterloo, Normandy Beach, you name it. There are more histories of the Little Bighorn than any of these battles. And there have been dozens of movies. By something like 1913, I think, there had already been 5 movies made about Custer's Last Stand. There is a fascination, and it has come to me that maybe because this battle decided nothing. It didn't turn history. It postponed the inevitable. Yes, it was a great, great victory for the Indians, but it did nothing but postpone what was going to happen to them anyway. They were going to be defeated. They were going to be taken back to the reservation, sent back to the reservations, and they were within a year. So it changed nothing, accomplished nothing, and maybe that forces us to look at the human drama, isolate the human drama. At Gettysburg, my last novel was about Gettysburg. These guys died for something, in my view. Lincoln explained it, defined it in the Gettysburg Address. They didn't die for anything at the Little Bighorn. It was a tragic, tragic human drama, and all of a sudden the characters, the people, become interesting because of this. Now that's the best I can do for you. The other thing about it was a massacre, and We read about massacres, we think about them, and there is this moment when everybody who was left with Custer, there's this moment when they all knew they were going to die. And we wonder about that. We wonder what that was like, what went through their minds. There was quite a bit of mystery attached to it. It was a long time before historians, and it took an anthropological expedition exhuming arrowheads and shell casings to solve how exactly that battle went and how it went so disastrously for Custer and his men. So there's a lot of mystery as to what happened, but we still don't know what Custer's final minutes were like, the final minutes of any of these guys were like, and we speculate, we wonder about it, and I think that's part of the fascination. Also, finally, there was a very interesting cast of characters.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Hardly heroes, most of them not heroes,
but interesting.
Sort of fun.
As you say.
Yeah, they were sort of fun.
And so now Lieutenant Armstrong Custer's military career had been a controversial one even before the Battle of Little Big Horn. Despite leading many victorious battles in the Civil War, he was later court-martialed and found guilty. Tell us more about his military career and his reputation.
You've done your homework. He was a Civil War hero. This people tend to forget this, or they don't know it today. And I always find myself saying, you know, you've got to remember something about Custer. He was a real Civil War hero. Everybody knew him. He was glamorous. He was incredibly courageous, and he really did help the Union cause. He was instrumental in the on the third day at the Battle of Gettysburg. He fought engagements all across Virginia and very significant ones. General Sheridan was so appreciative that he gave Custer and his wife the little table on which Grant and Lee signed the surrender as a token of his appreciation. It was Custer who rode out to accept the flag of surrender from Lee. So he was prominent, and he was a true Civil War hero. I said there were more histories of the Little Big Horn than of any other battle. There are more photographs of Custer than of Lincoln, if you can believe that. So he had an aura, he had fame, he had pretty much earned that fame going into the his subsequent career on the plains. The plains, it got a little controversial. He was reckless. He led an attack. His 7th Cavalry attacked a sleeping Cheyenne village by a river in Kansas called the Washita or the Washita. Women and children were killed. They slaughtered the pony herd. It was a sleeping village. The chief of that village, a man named Black Kettle, wanted to make peace. He did not. He was not a recalcitrant, and it was considered a great victory, and it made Custer's reputation as an Indian fighter. But it was very questionable, and has hurt Custer's reputation since then. I deal with this in the novel. It comes up again and again in the novel. The male protagonist, is very troubled by it. Yes, he deserted his command and raced back to the fort to be with his wife on one famous occasion, was court-martialed for that. He was impetuous. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of things rashly and impetuously, and I think there's a lot of hubris in the story of the Little Bighorn.
Yeah. He also had this, I guess, a flair, you would call it. I mean, he was charismatic, he dressed flamboyantly. I guess he's one of those people, as you said before we went on there, people loved him or hated him.
They loved him or hated him. Yeah. And if you hate him, it's infuriating to see his, you know, black velvet jacket and gilt spurs and so on. But he walked the walk. Mm-hmm. He was always at the front of the charge. He wore a red cravat bandana so that he would be conspicuous and his men could see that he was leading the charge. Mm-hmm. But he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, and they did call him a glory hunter, and I think he was.
So your novel is written from the perspective of a survivor of the Battle of Little Big Horn, Alan Winslow, an East Coast college-age civilian who's been coerced into service as Custer's personal secretary, and we're going to talk more about Alan in a moment, but it's Alan's mother who is having an affair with Custer, who presses him to go, and we're introduced to Custer as an adulterous man and, yet, as we're saying, a charming one to both men and women.
He was, and whether he was really an adulterer is a question. There are a lot of suggestions of it in his correspondence with his wife, whom he did love, and he loves her in the novel. But we don't know if he was truly an adulterer, and I'm going to hear about this, I think, from some Custer files. He was rumored to have had an affair with a beautiful Cheyenne woman named Mona Sita, and some people are absolutely sure this happened, and others deny it. In the novel, yes, he does. The Alan Winslow's mother is made up, beautiful actress, the sort of person that Custer would certainly know. He knew an actor named Lawrence Barrett, a great Shakespearean actor. They were very good friends, and he moved in those circles. So this was not plausible at the very least.
Well, you know, you say you're going to hear from some of the Custer fans about this, but it is fiction. I mean, there's a certain amount of this that is based in fact, but then there's also the fictional side of this. So tell us about walking that line where you say, okay, I'm sticking with fact here, but the rest of this, I'm just going to have some fun with.
Yeah, I think it's got to be plausible given what we know about the character, people who argue whether Custer had the affair with the Cheyenne Mona Sita will admit that he was captivated by her beauty. He writes about her lovely silken black hair and her figure and so on. Elizabeth Custer, the wife, took note of her husband's interest in this woman. So there was clearly more than just a friendship here. He was drawn to her. There's no question. So it's not a very wide line to cross to have him have an affair with her. But it has to be plausible, Mindy. And I think that Custer as an adulterer is very, very plausible. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people think he was. Yeah. But you can't have him be somebody who he wasn't. I have him somewhat rueful about the Washita, what happened there, thinking about slaughtering the ponies and the fact that children were killed. It bothers him in my novel. Did it bother the real Custer? It may have. Yeah, it may have. There are people who say, no, of course not. He didn't care. But I believe he very well might have cared. And after a while, the character becomes the character. You know, right. He's no longer the historical figure. he's my Custer. But he's pretty close. And you hear things about him that jibe with the character you're writing. He brushed his teeth obsessively. He was obsessed with cleanliness. Well, that just fits the man that I was writing.
Your Custer, yeah. So Alan makes the trip to join Custer by train from the East Coast to Fort Lincoln in the Dakotas. He's again pressed into service as the companion to a young woman, Addie Grace Lord, who is leaving her guardians to go to her brother, George Lord, who's a surgeon with Custer's regiment. Tell us a little bit more about train travel in the late 1880s. There are a lot of rough characters, rough conditions, not really the place for an unaccompanied woman.
I knew nothing about it when I started out. I had to do an enormous amount of research. I have a good friend named Carl Zimmerman, lives in New Jersey, who's a train writer. He's written any number of books about trains and train travel. And he has a wealth of knowledge, and he sent me a couple of books about train travel in the 19th century. I found people on the internet who are train buffs who provided me with documents and pictures and everything. So I had to learn what the inside of a day coach looked like, what happened when night came. Did you sleep on the train? All of these things. And people traveled that way. And yes, there were unsavory people. You had to be careful. You had to watch yourself. And of course, that I had fun with that because I could bring anyone on board the train and make anything happen. But there was a lot of anecdotal stuff about pickpockets and card cheats and con artists of all sorts. They'd get on the train and ride a while and find a mark and take advantage.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking as you're talking about this, and I cannot remember the fellow's name, but the guy who gets on, who they see the gun, he's got the gun, and he's kind of getting angry with it. Now, Alan and the young lady have also picked up another friend, Irwin, another young man. So these are young people. Yeah. And this guy gets on, and he thinks they're sassing him.
Yeah.
And he's letting them know. He'll just shoot him dead right now.
We're out west now. In fact, we're almost to Bismarck, North Dakota, which is their destination. So they're in the West, and this guy, yes, guy gets on. He's got a 44 strapped to his waist, and he's a tough character. We find out later that he's sold guns to the Indians. He runs a brothel, and he doesn't want to be sassed. It's the boy Irwin who sort of starts it, who's a mouthy, spunky, mouthy kid. He gets them all in trouble. Plus, he's giving Addie Grace the eye, and that's offensive to Alan and to her, of course.
That's a lot of fun. We're talking with John Huff Jr. His book is A Little Bighorn. We'll talk more after a quick break.
So we're on the beach that's also part of Cedar Tree Neck with Vineyard Sound in front of us. And right across from us, you can see a strip of beach and a lighthouse that's called Tarpaulin Cove on Nawshawn Island. And back in the 1800s, this was an extremely important and busy thoroughfare for sailing vessels and commerce going from New York to Boston.
That's Eric Kipp of Edgartown.
So they had to wait for the tide, and they would often go into Tarpaulin Cove, where there was actually a hotel, and I'm told a brothel to boot. And they would also stay in Vineyard Haven. The old postcards of ships in waiting for the tides, just packed with masts and ships. During that time, the ships had to pass from New York through Long Island Sound, and then again into Vineyard Sound, pass through Nantucket Sound, and go all the way out through the Nantucket Shoals, around Cape Cod and back into Boston. This was all at the time before the Cape Cod Canal was built, which was around 1913, 1914, was even proposed back as early as the late 17th century, 1670 or something. So it was obviously a problem. There were many wrecks of these boats trying to get around Cape Cod to Boston.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking with John Huff Jr. about his novel, Little Bighorn. So we've been talking about this train journey that Addie Grace and Alan are on, and they fall in love, and we get a better sense of who they are.
Alan doesn't want to go, and he has to go. His mother doesn't have any place for him to stay. She's doing a play in Washington. She doesn't want to pay for put him up in a hotel all summer. She prevails on Custer to take him along, as Custer did take his 18-year-old nephew and his 27-year-old brother. This would not have been plausible, except that Custer did that. So, Alan, this fit very nicely for me. And he dislikes the whole idea. So when he's told he's got to mind this girl, be the nanny, as he says, he doesn't like that either. Well, she's a pretty good-looking girl, and she's strong and spunky herself, and the sparks start to fly pretty quickly. I think reading the novel, you're going to know this is going to happen.
You see it coming.
You can see it coming.
I love how he calls her Brat, though. Wake up, Brat. Yeah. Go to sleep,
well,
Brat.
He's 2 years older than she is, and he sort of takes that role as her protector. She's full of indignation at first. I don't need a protector. She's going to go see her brother, and she doesn't care who's with her or who's not with her. And she has run away from school. She's a fugitive.
Yeah. And she learns quickly that it was a good thing that she has.
She learns very quickly.
Alan
she realizes, and admits it.
Yeah. And so Alan and Addie Grace arrive at Fort Lincoln, and although it's the frontier, there are some rough and tumble saloons and brothels. Fort Lincoln itself, though, is somewhat of an oasis. Custer's home is lavish, the white picket fence and the veranda. And then there are the wives of those higher up in the Army who have accompanied their husbands to the frontier. So describe life at Fort Lincoln. It's hard to think of these wives in the frontier, but it happened.
You used the word oasis, and you're right. You can see it today. They've rebuilt the Custer house, and it's a large, commodious house, the parlor and bay windows. They had musical instruments, the books on the walls. It was a civilized place, and an oasis, as you say, because Bismarck across the river was a rough western town. Brothels and saloons, guys were getting killed there almost literally daily in saloon fights and so on. But you got over to Lincoln, and yes, the picket fence and the officers' houses were very nice. The enlisted men lived in barracks, and it was like they were like barracks anywhere, even now. But the officers lived quite civilized lives. They had a theater. They had plays. The traveling troops would come and put on shows. There's a show going on the night Alan and Addie Grace arrived. They had musical evenings. They played the piano. They played charades. It was an enclave, a quite pleasant enclave, and such a contrast because, you know, go a few miles west of there and you could get shot with an arrow. But it was a nice sort of pleasant place. Sleigh rides in the wintertime, picnics. There's a wonderful, quite famous photograph of a picnic by the Little Heart River. It was just about a year before most of the men in the picture died, and they're there with their wives under a canopy. Women with dresses and parasols, picnic baskets, and the men sort of lounging in the shade. It looks idyllic, and it was. Just a few miles from Lincoln.
And as we talked about earlier, during this time period, there were some Native Americans who had agreed to stop fighting over territories with the encroaching whites and live on reservations. But there were others who did not. Custer's objective was to clear the area of Lakota and Cheyennes and force them onto the Great Sioux Reservation. So before this infamous battle of the Little Bighorn, it seemed that Custer was more concerned with the Lakota and Cheyenne escaping than he was in fighting them. So perhaps one of his first mistakes?
But this people are arguing about that to this day, Mindy. The Indians were, no one thought they were chickens, but they were guerrilla fighters. They fought, they struck and ran, they struck and ran. They were incredibly brave and no one thought they weren't, but they didn't stand and fight in a pitched battle. And the assumption, not just by Custer, but by everyone and going all the way up to General Sheridan in Chicago, was that they were going to run and they were going to scatter, and the real challenge was to bring them, to engage them, to bring them to battle. Everyone was in a hurry and everyone was worried about this, and Custer has been roundly criticized for 150 years for attacking when he did, and it seemed impetuous, and it was impetuous in a way. But on the other hand, he was operating under the assumption that was everybody's assumption, that you've got to engage and they're going to scatter. The word scatter was everyone was using. We've got to get them before they scatter. The Indians are going to scatter. They didn't scatter that day, as we know. But, yeah. You know, everyone thought they were going to. And he was in a rush. The other thing, no one knew, Custer nor General Sheridan or any of them, how many Indians there were there. It was the biggest gathering of Native people on the North American continent ever, and nobody knew it. One reason they didn't know it was because thousands of them left the reservations, and the reservation agents didn't tell anybody because their food allowance would have been cut, and they didn't want that. They wanted to pocket what they didn't need, use to feed the braves who had left the reservation, so they weren't reporting it. Nobody knew. It finally began to leak out. People find, and in the novel, they get a telegram that suddenly says, you know, there are going to be more people there than we thought.
Custer used Native Americans as guides and interpreters,
yes.
And he had strong and personal relationships with them, yet this didn't change his view about the right of the natives to their land or the morality of going to battle with them.
Custer was a soldier. He was a warrior, and I think that he had nothing against slavery. He had nothing against the Confederacy. He respected them. He respected their prowess in battle. But he fought them very hard and courageously because it was his job. He respected his enemies. And I would go so far as to say he respected the Sioux and the Cheyenne as enemies. But it was his job to fight them. He was a soldier. He was a warrior. That was what he did. He didn't have moral compunctions about what they were doing to them, sending them back to the reservation, about killing them. He killed many a Confederate himself, yet he respected them and thought that slavery was just fine, but it was his job. And I think that he probably respected the Sioux and the Cheyenne in the way that he respected Jeb Stuart and his opponents in the Civil War. Certainly there was some racism in him, but, you know, his own, the native people, the Crows and the Arikara Ree scouts, they loved him.
Yeah. And so these guys were telling Custer that he was vastly outnumbered by the Native Americans in the encampment, that the army was about to attack. But Custer either didn't believe them or didn't seem to think it mattered. Like the guy on the train who says, you know, tell Custer. There's more than he thinks. So yeah. There were these little signs.
There were.
And he just...
He went anyway. Yeah, I think it was a little of both. He didn't believe them, and he wanted to go. And he wanted
he'd be a
to
bigger
go
hero.
Anyway. He'd be a bigger hero, and he was unable to imagine losing the battle, let alone getting massacred with 200 some men. It had never happened, yeah. And nobody could imagine. When the news came back, the nation was stunned. We were out there 4 years ago, and someone told us, I think it was a Native woman, Native American Cheyenne woman, who said, you know, it was like 9/11 when the nation found out what had happened, that the great General Custer was annihilated. Yeah. Half his regiment.
Yeah, we should talk about that, how he went from general to lieutenant colonel.
Well, no, that's... he never, in a way, he never did, Mindy. General was his brevet rank during the Civil War, which is a temporary rank. And he was a brigadier general, so he led a brigade. That's what that means. When the war is over, he reverts to his former rank, which is lieutenant colonel. But he was known by the country, by his adoring fans, as General Custer. He was
right.
The general.
The people who liked him called him the general.
His wife referred to him in the third person, the general this and the general that. And people did. His friends did. So he remained General Custer all his life. And I think a lot of people then and a lot of people now don't realize that he wasn't actually a general.
He wasn't actually a general. Now, as you just mentioned, you did extensive research, obviously, to put this book together. And that included a trip to the site of the battlefield. So tell us about that experience walking on that battlefield.
We spent a week. My wife was with me, and we had been there years and years ago with my parents. My father had always wanted to see it, and we finally went. And this was 1985. This time, I spent close to a week and going out there every single day. I like to compare it to the battlefield at Gettysburg, which I also know pretty intimately. Gettysburg is green and peaceful. You have a sense of, even in spite of the horror and the awful, awful carnage that took place there, it's green, it's quiet. There's the National Cemetery, which is a very somber and lovely place. And you get this sense of peace in Gettysburg. There are people who might disagree with me, but I felt it very, very strongly. At the Little Bighorn, you feel that these ghosts are not happy. It's wide open, looks just the way it did in 1876. No trees have grown up where there weren't trees years ago. They don't grow except along creeks and rivers. It's hot, dry. The hills are dry and covered with sagebrush, and the sky is immense, and the land seems hostile and stark. And I swear the ghosts there are not happy. They're not at peace. They died for nothing, and they died hideous deaths, many of them.
I was going to say, your novel has an extensive battle sequence that takes place over several chapters, and not only are the scenes you write graphic and violent, they're filled with emotion, courage, resignation, fear, sadness. Talk about writing those scenes.
I don't know if people will take it this way, but I like to think of this book as an anti-war novel. I wanted to write the battle scenes in all their horror. Little Bighorn has been romanticized. It has been celebrated. Errol Flynn, they died with their boots on, you know, this sort of glorious end of going down fighting bravely. And it was not something to celebrate. It was not something to romanticize. It was horrible. It was horrible. At the end, someone says, "I don't want to give things away," but it was human beings at their worst It was a killing field, white and red, and I wanted the battle scenes to be as horrific as I could make them, because that's the point.
That was the reality.
That was the reality of it, and it's the message of the novel.
And we see the battle through the eyes of Alan Winslow, and he views some horrific things. And although he's a civilian, he finds himself in a position of having to choose between killing a Native American or being killed himself. And this is tough because he's not a soldier. He's a civilian.
Well, I don't want to give too much away here, Mindy. I was a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. and people smile at this. I've now written two battle novels.
Right.
I've never been in combat. I've only done research, read about it, read accounts of it. But the novelist should be able to. Stephen Crane never saw a battle when he wrote The Red Badge of Courage. Mm-hmm. So, novelist should be able to use his or her imagination and get this done. I think at this moment when Alan is confronted by this choice, I like to think he does what I would have done. I don't know. You don't know.
Yeah,
what
you don't
you're
know
going
until
to do
you're in that moment.
Until you're in that
you
moment.
You think you know.
And, you know, when this is during the Vietnam War, when there were a lot of us conscientious objectors, and we would get counseled, and they would say, you're going to get asked, would you kill to save your mother's life? Would you kill to save your own life? If your answer is yes, you're not a CO. But they said, don't answer yes. Say you don't know. You only know what you would like to do. What you would like to do. That's the best you can
do. That's a good answer.
As an answer, yeah.
And of course, again, we don't want to give away too much of the plot. So we won't talk about what happens between Alan and Addie Grace. But tell us about the public reaction to Custer's defeat.
All right. Well, you have said there's a survivor,
mm-hmm.
and I'm gonna venture this, Min. There is a survivor, and I'm surprised no one has thought of writing a survivor story the way I did. I'm surprised no one ever thought of this. I'm lucky that they didn't. And also, let me say, and then we'll talk about that. Yeah. Over the years, over 100 people came, sort of out of the woodwork, and announced that they had been with Custer. They had survived. There were hundreds, literally 110, 20 claims by men who said they had been with Custer and survived. They were all dismissed. But there isn't an historian, the battle, who will tell you that it wouldn't have been possible. Mm-hmm. They all say, oh yeah, it absolutely could have happened.
So you ran with that.
So I ran with that. But there isn't. That's one thing that's not going to happen. No one's going to say, well, it's impossible. No one could have survived because all the experts that told me, yeah, absolutely.
It could
have.
All right. So let's talk about the reaction to the defeat. Shock.
To the defeat?
Yeah. The public reaction to Custer's defeat was, what happened? How did this happen?
They didn't want to believe that the Indians could inflict this kind of disaster on white people, on white soldiers. The other night at Renaissance House, I told this story, and it got a great laugh. But it's true. A rumor started to go around that Sitting Bull was really a white person and had gone to West Point. They couldn't imagine that a Native person could have inflicted a defeat like this. It was brilliantly fought by the Indians. I mean, they took advantage of what was happening on the other side. They Crazy Horse led a charge. He split Custer. The men with Custer went right through, split them in two parts. They were brilliant. As a battle, that was a textbook battle on the from the Indian side. The white side was not textbook at all. There was panic. There was disorganization. There was a lot of dysfunction. But anyway, it was a shock that this could happen to our guys. And I suppose, you know, you could imagine a massacre in Iraq now or Afghanistan. Many, many, many men killed to a man. How upset and angry the country would be. And then we throw in the dislike and the racism toward the Native people, and you get an idea how. And there was fury. People were furious.
Yeah. So, what would you say is the legacy then of the Battle of Little Bighorn?
The legacy is cultural, and it's one of the great romances of the American West, which I try to debunk in the novel. Custer's Last Stand as a phrase is full of romance. Custer's Last Stand. It left Custer as a famous Western hero. Everyone knows who Custer was. He's like Wyatt Earp, Billy the Kid. He's in that pantheon. So culturally, it left us with a kind of adventure story, Mindy. I think that's the right word, which I try to counter with the novel. It was a great victory for the Indians, and I think they understandably celebrate it today. But it, as I said at the beginning, it did nothing but postpone the inevitable, their inevitable defeat. So the legacy, and maybe the legacy was to bring the our subjugation, our oppression of the native people to the forefront, make everybody very conscious of it. It's interesting to me that I think, and when I wrote my previous novel, Seen the Glory, I thought strongly that this country has never really looked at slavery and regretted it in the way that we ought to have regretted it. Whereas our treatment of the native peoples is generally acknowledged. Very hard to find anyone today who will not shake his or her head and say it was an awful thing that we did. The movies, the white guys are the bad guys now. Always Dances with Wolves, all of these movies. I think we've faced up to what we did in a way that we haven't faced up to slavery. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Little Bighorn is sort of a conscious raiser. I imagine you could say too.
John Huff Jr., his book is The Little Bighorn. Thanks for coming in and talking with us about it. Always good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a story about eels, a magnificent animal that you probably don't think much about.
The late Milton Jeffers, Edgartown blacksmith, on quahog rakes.
Well, they don't make them like I make. I made mine from some of the old designs and a couple little things I added myself. A lot of guys years ago used to use these potato diggers, you know what they are, and they dig quahogs good, but when you turn the rake over to pick up the quahog, they'll fall out because there's nothing to hold them. So I combine that with a quahog rake, and I make one that the teeth go up, and I put catchers on the sides, so you would turn the rake over. Sometimes just three or four of them will stay right in the rake, and you just wash them out and put them in the tub. And none of these guys made them like that. We used to use these mill spindles for teeth, and they're very high carbon steel, and they're tapered, and they're quite long. And all you have to do is heat them and flatten them out, and then grind them to shape. And then I have a jig that I can make all different size rakes. I bend each tooth around a jig, so when I get through, I can make 10 of them. They're all identical. Then I just drill a back, and I have another jig that lines them up. I put them together, and then pound out a shank and weld that on. And I've never seen any others like them.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.
You're listening to The Point. The American eel is in trouble. East Asian markets have set skyrocketing prices for the young glass eels, which are illegal to catch in Massachusetts. Still, poachers do. Contributor Cara Ginesco tells us the story of the eels, their remarkable migration, and the people trying to protect them.
Trust me, it's not easy to run in the dark, chasing behind Officer Chuck Martinson. Chuck's just bounded over the guardrail towards the water. He stops. He pulls out a thermodynamic camera and scans the shoreline. Chuck's on the hunt.
If you've got someone that's been standing in a certain area and they've, you know, there's heat radiating through their boots, you can actually see, you know, if someone's sitting up on a hillside, you'll see the transfer of that heat actually onto the ground.
The cloak of night, the badge, the urgency. You might think he was after cocaine dealers. But this illegal trade? Eels. Live, baby eels. The American eel is in jeopardy.
The one benefit that we have, you know, working these areas is that, you know, we know about every inch of these woods. if you do have someone and they're trying to sneak away and poaching of glass seals, usually we can get ahead of them in pretty quick order.
That's Chuck. He's a bit of a badass.
Hold tight.
The best kind of badass. The kind that would never think of himself that way.
So what we likely had over there was probably a fox or a coyote.
He's a Falmouth game warden. He drives a black unmarked truck and catches fish in his bare hands. In addition to police training, he knows how to read or interpret things like otter scat and nocturnal birds.
You know, at the first sight of a human, they'll flush out of an area. When you see that and they fly away, you're pretty secure that no one's down there.
People fish for eels at all of their life stages, young to adult. But at the heart of the poaching problem are the glass eel, the transparent babies, or the elver, a few weeks older and darker in color. Chuck shows me a hot spot where the glass eels are running, but I had to promise not to tell you where they are.
You see the color of this guy right here?
Yeah.
If you look at that one in comparison to, we'll pull another one out. You see how these ones you can actually see through?
He lets one squirm in his hand. It's true. They are transparent. I can see little poppy seed eyes through its head.
Pull another one out.
The eels face plenty of problems. Climate change, polluted habitat, dammed rivers. Poaching glass eels in Elver is just the most recent and controversial. Fishing for adult eel is legal, but there are only two states where it's legal to fish young eels, Maine and South Carolina. In 2012, the glass eel market reached nearly $40 million, causing a gold rush. Profits were second only to lobster. It's illegal to fish for glass eels in Elvers in Massachusetts, and it's illegal to fish without a license. But for many, the temptation to poach is irresistible.
You know, the take-home message here is that you have to remain vigilant. You know, you got to imagine that, you know, these people are probably doing, you know, some level of counter-surveillance on their own nets and everything else, so they could very well be setting up cameras to see if we're checking on their gear. You know, a lot of these people are hunters, they're fishermen, they're outdoorsmen. They play the game just like we play the game.
How did this happen? Why are eel prices such that we need surveillance to protect them? In Japan, Kobayaki Unagi, grilled eel over rice, is a way of life. After 2011's devastating tsunami, the prized Japanese eel population was decimated. But that didn't stop the high demand. American glass eels are bought primarily by China, where they are raised to maturity and then shipped to Japan. Often, Japan sells them back to the U.S. for sushi restaurants. It's a round-the-world trip for the eels.
What we're looking for here in this area is, you can see the algae in the bottom. If there's any area on the bottom of this that's been disturbed, you'll actually see the boot prints, which will actually physically be in here.
On the way back to the truck, I ask Chuck if he ever gets spooked. I ask him if poachers are armed.
You know, it's a kind of a doggy-dog world when you're out here. You know, these are people that are out here in the middle of the night. When you're dealing in the amount of money that these guys are dealing with, they're likely carrying, you know, weapons, most likely to protect themselves from other individuals.
It's after 2 a.m. and time for Chuck to go home. He and his team have to be up again at 8 for training and river maintenance. Glass eels and elvers will keep him busy all spring. Eels begin life in an unknown pocket of the Sargasso Sea. No one has seen them spawn. The ribbony larvae change into clear little leaf shapes that catch the Gulf Stream. Once they hit the continental shelf, they transform again into transparent mini-eel. Glass eel, the length of your index finger. They fan out along the coastline and struggle their way upstream to fresh water. They battle birds, bigger fish, raccoons, and their worst foe, human predators. This migration isn't the only thing that makes eels so mysterious. They have a lot of unusual traits. They are so determined to get where they are going that if the banks are wet, say after a rain, they will slither out of the water for a shortcut across land.
They're just undulating, you know, it's almost snake-like, but they absolutely moving the direction of the water, so they must be able to sense where the water is. And I have heard from people where they've seen lots of glass eels doing this, and it's like a sea of eels moving across, say, a grass lawn or something.
That's Brad Chase, a senior marine fisheries biologist. Brad works with Chuck to maintain the fishways, and his team count the migrating eels. Brad says he has seen remarkable declines in eel abundance in his career. he worries that people won't take interest until it's too late.
I think we're at that point. They depend on clean habitats in the freshwater, so we've degraded their habitat, and we've over-harvested them when they come back to us. So if we do slip and we can't protect them, it could be really hard to bring them back.
In 2010, the American eel was considered for protection under the endangered species list. It didn't make it. The status for the eels is up for review again soon and will be decided in 2015. The numbers that Brad collects this season are key. He explains that the species is an important part of the ecosystem. Everything eats eels. But for him, it goes deeper than that.
They're an important native species to the ecology of these rivers. They belong here. The early settlers were taught by the Native Americans how to catch eel to help them survive. And it was really important for hundreds of years. And I'd hate to lose that completely.
Currently, the penalties for glass eeling in Maine without a license are hefty. $2,000 in fines, loss of license, and for repeat offenders, possible jail time. In Massachusetts, the fines harken back to a time before there was a problem, amounting to little more than a $50 to $100 slap on the wrist. When glass eels are sold for thousands, there's little incentive for poachers to stop.
I would like to see penalties and prosecutions that really put the hammer down, and that's what I hope happens. I'm working very hard. A lot of people are working very hard to restore eel populations. We don't want those sacrifices to go to a handful of people. I want to see a reaction.
The Atlantic States Marine Fishery Commission works across state lines to advocate for better regulations. In the meantime, I got a text from Chuck Martinson. There was something I had to see. A neighbor called Chuck to let him know about a suspicious vehicle. Chuck and Brad consulted and decided to do something new, something radical, a sort of glass eel relocation program. I met Chuck and his team at the banks of the stream. At their feet are two huge white coolers.
Because we didn't have enough cooler space at one point for the amount of elvers that we had, we actually had to go ahead and borrow a cooler from a fisherman in the area.
Using dip nets, they pull in hundreds of eels out of the stream. Once they've filled the coolers, they drive the eels to a hidden spot. Before they slowly release the juvenile eels into the water, they measure them in a liter container.
You can hear that noise that they make. You're wild.
It almost sounds like a pot of boiling water.
Yeah.
They're moving so fast.
On this day, they rescued 35 pounds. That's about 87,500 eels, with an estimated street value of $28,000.
See, the minute they hit the water, they just disperse. It's amazing.
Chuck throws his waders in the back of the truck. He'll be back for night patrols. But for right now, he looks pleased with the transfer. For the eels that Chuck relocated, it's not exactly over. If they make it to adulthood, they will stay in that lake for up to 10 years. And then, they will get the urge to travel back to the Sargasso Sea. They'll slip into rivers and go downstream, if it is dark enough and the rain has slicked down the beach. They'll slip across it. In open water, their homing devices do what we can't. They find their birthplace. They spawn only once, and then they die. The new generation sweeps into the Gulf Stream. Brad will count them. Chuck might save them. If all goes well, they'll end at the beginning, somewhere underneath the sargassum seaweed.
Glass eels and elvers run every spring in April and May. This story came to us from the Transom Story Workshop run by our media partners, Atlantic Public Media. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.